on you.
Okay.
She's coming, if that's okay with you.
Yes, is that turned on or have to
wait? It's on.
Okay. Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
My name is Kim, and I am a recovered compulsive overeater.
Hi, Kim.
And like Bonnie said, I am from South Jersey, out in the Mount Holly area. Just to qualify, I've been in OA about 20 years, but unfortunately I used it for many years as a diet club with group support. And about 4 years ago, I hit what I call, thank you, Dave, a spiritual bottom, and I became a student of the Big Book, and in the mere 6 weeks, had the obsession to eat removed. And what that means is not that I can white-knuckle it through the day, not that I have to chase tools around all day in order to distract myself, but I no longer want my binge foods. That is the miracle that these 12 steps offer us. I have experienced all aspects of this disease in my early 20s. I was a size 24, and when I walked up and down the stairs in my parents' house, I had to stop because I would get so out of breath. My doctor threatened to put me on high blood pressure medication. I then, in Overeaters Anonymous, dieted down to a size 2, where I lost my period and my hair was starting to fall out. Mm-hmm. I've also been the size I currently am now, which is a size 10, binging and purging and exercising to the point there was a couple times I actually passed out in the gym and hit my head because I was making up for a binge or earning a binge. I don't even remember which. So there is no peace in this disease unless we get a spiritual awakening, which is what we're going to talk about tonight. And I gave grace. We were asked by my inner group. You can start handing out. We were asked by my inner group to write a 3-minute elevator speech, meaning that go under the assumption that a newcomer comes up to you after the meeting and says, I have 3 minutes before I have to go. Can you tell me what a compulsive overeater is? And what would you tell them? And one of the girls liked what I wrote so much, she made it into a bookmarker. So I just wanted to hand that out because that's what this I'm going to be talking about tonight. I'm having a hard time with this. Is we're going to talk about what is a compulsive overeater. And I'm going to use the Big Book and my own experience to illustrate that. Because I have to tell you, for many, many years in Overeaters Anonymous, when I don't know how your meetings are, but we always say, are there any other compulsive overeaters here besides myself? And I would raise my hand. And what I didn't realize is I was raising my hand saying, I am fat and I don't want to be fat anymore, or I am no longer fat and I'm terrified of getting fat again. I had no idea what I suffered from. And it wasn't until the delusion of the doctor's opinion smashed that to an extent that I surrendered to the steps in a way that I never did for the first 17 years that I was in program. So we're going to start out with the doctor's opinion, and we're going to learn what the doctor says, what the medical diagnosis is. So I don't know if any of you guys have your Big Books, but if not, I will read the sections. So I'm going to go to, if you have the fourth edition, page XXVIII. Because who is Dr. Silkworth? How many of you guys know the Big Book? I mean, are you familiar with it? Okay, because I don't want to leave anybody out who's never done the Big Book, but Dr. Silkworth is a physician that back in the 1930s worked with the founder of AA, Bill Wilson. It's estimated he worked with about 50,000 alcoholics. And what he started to notice was this pattern. There were a certain amount of alcoholics that would come into the hospital. He would dry them out, and they would leave, and he would never, ever see them again. And then there was another percentage of them that would come in, and they would come back a couple times, and he would simply explain to them, look, it looks like alcohol doesn't agree with you. I suggest that you don't drink alcohol. And they would leave the hospital and they would never come back again. But there was a certain small percentage of them, no matter how many times he dried them out, no matter how many times he explained that you cannot drink liquor, they would return over and over and over. And he described them as the chronic alcoholic. Okay, so what this theory was that he had, this opinion that he had was number one, that their body processes alcohol differently than the normal drinker. That when they ingest that substance, their body reacts in such a way it creates a craving. They want more and more and more. That feeling intensifies, never satisfies. But the bigger part was, even if he could physically separate them from the alcohol, contain them in this hospital, where they were no longer having that reaction, there was something going on up here in their mind that told them, come on, it wasn't that bad. This time you'll be able to control it. And it was that dangerous combination that he called the true alcoholic. Okay, so we're going to look to see what does that mean. So on XXVIII, it says, we believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. So any alcoholics in here? Okay, so if I sat down with these alcoholics, okay, I am not an alcoholic. So what's going to happen is all of us will have 5 shots of tequila. We're all going to get drunk because that is the normal response to alcohol. The difference is I'm going to feel a little bit sick. I'm going to feel a little bit nauseous. I don't like that feeling. I'm feeling a little bit out of control. I don't want any more alcohol. The alcoholics are going to get charged up. They're going to get excited. They're going to feel like they're more in control, and they want that feeling more and more and more. So they're not only going to drink the alcohol I don't want, they're going to go out and search out more alcohol. So if in a group of 10 people, if 8 out of 10 people react like me, and 2 out of 10 people react like the alcoholic, it simply means they have an abnormal reaction. That's all an allergy is. You know, today we think of an allergy being the scratchy eyes, you know, a cough, a rash. And I thought to myself, you know, how can I be allergic to pasta? I can eat enough pasta for a family of 10. I'm not having any reaction. What I didn't realize is the fact I was eating enough for a family of 10 was the allergic reaction. So what this did is this took the shame out of it for me. So when I went to birthday parties and someone would have a piece of cake and I would sit there beating myself up because I don't have the willpower to have a piece of cake, what I didn't realize is after a piece of cake, they might have felt a little bit sick. They might have felt a little bit nauseous. They don't like that feeling. They don't want any more cake. They don't have willpower. What I had to recognize is what the food did for me is not what the food did for them. What they do is they look at me and see what the food is doing to me and wonder why I'm doing it. I know what the food does for me, and I'm wondering why they're not doing it. Okay, so that's why this never occurs in the average temperate drinker. Now, with compulsive overeaters, one way that we are a little unique in this fellowship is that we all don't have the same allergy. Okay, when an alcoholic comes into an AA meeting, they know alcohol is alcohol is alcohol. We have to figure out, what are those foods that create that phenomenon of craving? What are those foods that once you ingest, they charge you up? You get excited. You have to have more. I don't know about you, but I've never woken up in the middle of the night going, God, I gotta have a Brussels sprout right now. So in a way, I do know there's certain foods that charge me up. I've never felt that way about a Brussels sprout. Okay, so we're going to drop to the bottom of that page. It says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. Their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. So really what I thought when I came into OA is I really like Oreos. Can you please teach me how to only eat 3 Oreos? Okay? I just like the taste of food. But then I had to look at my history. Did I eat food when it was spoiled? Yes. Did I eat food when it was burnt? Yes. Did I eat food that was frozen that should have been defrosted? Yes. So there's something else going on besides I like the taste of certain foods. The example I often use is one of my favorite binge foods is pizza. And I would order a pie and I would have half the pie and go, I'm not going to have the other half. And I'd wrap it in tinfoil and put it in the refrigerator. And then invariably 2 o'clock in the morning, I'd get up and I would eat the pizza, not heat it, just eat the pizza cold. And then I'm like, I can't do this anymore. And I would take the pizza and I would throw it in the trash in the tinfoil. And I would get up 2 o'clock in the morning and I would go in the trash and I'd pull out the pizza. Then I'm like, I can't do this. So I would not put it in tinfoil and I'd throw it in the trash. And invariably I'd get up at 2 o'clock in the morning and I would wipe off the dust bunnies and I would eat the pizza. And then I got really desperate and I would actually put Ajax on the pizza. And I would still get up 2 o'clock in the morning, tears rolling down my eyes, because I had to have the pizza. Does that sound like someone who just likes the taste of pizza? I'm chasing an effect. And where they say it's elusive, where's Sarita back there?
Yes, dear.
Okay, so if I watch Ocean's 11, I know that George Clooney's in the movie. But the only thing I notice is Brad Pitt. And me and Sarita have a very... We have a plan about Brad and Angelina. We've got a plan going, the two of us. So I can't explain to you, I never made a decision to like blonde hair and blue eyes. But ever since I was in puberty, I walk into a room of 50 guys and the blonde hair, blue eye guys come out. It's elusive to me. Same thing with the food. I may not want to get honest about it, but I know which foods create that effect. I know which foods that when Hurricane Sandy came through Jersey, I know which ones I was willing to go out and get. Believe me, I wasn't getting up to get Brussels sprouts. Okay? So that is all talking about the allergy. Our alcoholic life is the only normal one, okay? We can't differentiate the true from the false. So the next part of this paragraph talks about the obsession of the mind, okay? It says we are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity. Okay, so what I thought was my problem is the food, right? I'm in the food, I'm miserable. My real problem is when I don't have the food. The problem isn't when I open up the bag of Doritos, the problem is when the bag of Doritos is gone. Because when I'm abstinent, I'm restless. I'm irritable, I'm discontent, I'm uncomfortable in my own skin. I can't stand that feeling. And my mind locks in on the idea that if I have one bite, I will get ease and comfort. Now, what sucks with our disease, that ease and comfort lasts 10 seconds. Which is why at the first couple bites, it's... And at the 100th bite, I'm shoving it in so fast I can't even taste what I'm eating. Okay, so my real problem is not the food. My real problem is abstinence. If I could get abstinent and get comfortable without doing the steps, I wouldn't need OA. So what happens? How does that cycle go together? It says here, after they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, the phenomenon of craving develops. So succumb to the desire, meaning we're abstinent. I'm not having an allergic reaction. It's only after I've succumbed, I've surrendered to that, that the craving happens. And that's different. For a normal person, they might say, oh, last Thanksgiving, you know, I can't wait to have Aunt Sally's apple pie again, because they're remembering the apple pie from last year. In the context of the doctor's opinion, we do not crave a food unless we ingest it. So when we're 2 weeks abstinent, 3 weeks abstinent, and we want that food more than anything, and we say, I can't get the cravings to go away, we're not craving. We're restless, we're irritable, we're discontent. It is the obsession of the mind that we're battling at that point. Does that make sense? Okay, so after we've succumbed to the desire again, the phenomenon of craving develops. Okay, so now the food's in us. We're craving that. The pass through the well-known stages of a spree. Emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. I swear to God, this is the last time. I'm never going to do it again. Monday's going to be different. The first of the month is going to be different. I might as well finish this bag, but I'm never going to have it again. But I swear to God, this time's going to be different. And this is going to happen over and over and over unless we have a psychic change. Okay? So I want to look at that word succumb. Because I'll tell you, my personal opinion, one of the things that hurts us in a way is we talk about a slip. And we talk about our food getting sloppy. Okay? A slip is an accidental fall. So I got a phone call about a year ago from a woman who said, I had a slip last night, and I'm telling on myself, and I'm back on track, and my sponsor said it's just a slip. So I called her back, and I said, can you tell me what happened? She goes, I was out to dinner with my family last night at a restaurant, and I had dessert. I said, okay, so let's define a slip. You're out at a restaurant. You ask for the dessert menu. He brings it to you. You make a decision which dessert you want to have. You wait for him to go away and come back, bring you the dessert, and you lift up the fork, and you have it. That is not a slip. That is succumbing to the desire again. And we have to take this as seriously as if an alcoholic called us and said, you know what, I'm a gin and tonic gal, and on the way home I hit a happy hour and I just had a couple beers. So I'm just going to consider it a slip, because I really prefer gin and tonic. I'm not a big beer person. How many times have we heard that? Well, I had the whole grain version of my binge food. It was fat-free. It was sugar-free. Because we are rationalizing that it's okay for us to have that food. We are either abstinent or we're not. It, you know, abstinence is black and white. Now, our food plan might change. Our food plan... Does anyone know the difference between abstinence and a food plan?
Please explain.
Okay. Abstinence has to do with what creates the phenomenon of craving. It either does or it doesn't. The behavior does or it doesn't. Black and white. Our food plan is our boundaries and limitations around the foods that we do eat. That's given to us by a doctor. That might be determined by how tall we are, what our age is, what our activity level is, you know, if we're pregnant, if we're breastfeeding, and that's going to change. What will never change is our abstinence, because it either creates the phenomenon of craving or it doesn't. So just one example, with me, if I can't eat a Snickers bar, I'm going to eat enough mashed potatoes to create that effect. So for that reason, volume triggers that effect, so I weigh and measure my food. I know people, and I sponsor people, that volume doesn't trigger it for them. It's just because of them needing the weight loss, they use weighing and measuring as a boundary so they know how much calories they're consuming. So for them, it's their food plan. For me, it's my abstinence. So we have to get real clear. I'm someone too. I get that craving from grazing. So I personally have to have very definitive and beginning and ending of each of my meals. Other people don't. Other people can... I'll just give an example. Do this morning when she came to my house. She had something before she came to my house, and then when she got to my house, she had the rest of her breakfast. I couldn't do that. That would trigger the effect in me. Other people can do that. So that's why we're different, but we have to get clear on what our specific abstinence is. Does that make sense to everybody?
Yes.
Okay, so we're going to skip now to the chapter, There is a Solution. And I know when I first read that, I thought to myself, how can there be one solution? You don't understand all the problems I have. But when I thought about it, I always had one solution. Now, one day it was a ding-dong, and one day it was a Dorito. But I've never had a problem and thought to myself, food won't solve this one. So why is it so crazy to think if I only had one solution in my life that maybe there is one other solution? Okay? Oops. So we're going to go into on page 20. Because part of knowing who what we are is knowing who we are not. Okay? Because everybody, I was telling someone this today, 2/3 of Americans are obese now. It doesn't mean 2/3 of Americans are compulsive overeaters. Just because you're heavy doesn't mean you're a compulsive overeater. I mean, I was reading a study the other week. One of the leading causes of obesity, they say now, is because of poverty. People can't afford fruits and vegetables. They're living on mac and cheese because it's the only thing they can afford for their family. You know, if you eat moderately McDonald's every day and sit in front of a computer for 12 hours, you're going to be heavy. So we have to know who we're not to know who we are. Okay, so on page 20, we're going to learn about the moderate eater, the heavy eater, and the true compulsive overeater. Okay, so the moderate eater, it says on 20, have little trouble in giving up liquor entirely if they have a good reason for it. They can take it or leave it alone. Okay, so I have a brother who is a moderate eater. He's never had a weight problem, he's always been thin, really doesn't care about food. Him and his wife sold their condo, and they were having a house built, and they lived with his in-laws for 6 months. And I saw him about 3-4 months in, and he put on like 30 or 40 pounds. And I'm like, Jeff, what the heck happened to you? He's like, oh, Kim, Mrs. Connolly is such a good cook. I come home every night, she's got 2 desserts, a full meal, it's wonderful. And I was like, oh, my God. As soon as they moved into that new house, he took the weight off. Because if it was there, he has it. If it's not, he could care less. That's the moderate eater. Those are the people that maybe can eat like us on Thanksgiving Day, but the day after Thanksgiving, they go back to eating their normal way. That's like my father. My father weighs himself before he goes on vacation. He usually gains 10 to 15 pounds because part of the vacation is enjoying the cuisine of the locals there. He comes back, weighs himself, and then just moderates his food till he gets back to his normal weight. That's a moderate eater. Okay, now we have the heavy eater. Now, the heavy eater might look like us, but it says in the top of 21, if a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warning of a doctor becomes operative, this man can also stop or moderate, although he may find it difficult or troublesome and may even need medical attention. So I have a friend of mine that 10 years ago, 4 young children, and her husband came home and said, sorry, honey, I'm leaving you for a woman half your age who's from France. She ate like me for 3 years. She had to declare bankruptcy. The guy still hasn't seen his kids after 10 years. She almost lost her house. You know, everything just fell apart. She put those kids to bed and ate herself to death every single night. I knew she wasn't a compulsive overeater, even though I knew she was behaving like me. Because once she got settled, once she accepted that her husband left, once she got a job where she could support the kids, whether or not there was child support, once her kids were like, okay, Mom, so what? You're getting divorced. Well, my friend's parents are divorced too. She simply bought a PX90 video, started shopping at Whole Foods, and she's fine. She's not a compulsive overeater. Okay, once again, to use myself as I am not an alcoholic, I am the heavy drinker. I could probably go into an AA meeting and tell a damn good story because my consequences of alcohol will mimic a lot of alcoholics. But when I was 27 years old, I drove drunk the wrong way down a highway and almost killed a friend of mine in May. I never drank for another 6 or 7 years. And then when I had a beer, I thought, I don't like beer. I'm not going to get drunk. Why would I even want this thing? Because I don't have the allergy. Now, what would have happened if that night I was driving the wrong way down the highway, I was caught by the cops? I would have been sentenced to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would have gone there, and they would have told me, don't drink, go to meetings. Think the drink through. And I would have been cool. Maybe I would have even dated a couple cute guys. You don't know. But I never would have had to work a step. Now, the danger is, what if I was going to AA like that, and I tried to sponsor a real alcoholic and told them, don't drink, go to meetings. Think the drink through. Keep it green. I would have killed people. So that's, unfortunately, you know, we do have to look at today. There's a lot of hard eaters and Overeaters Anonymous, and you'll know that because they're the people who come in, get a food plan, go to meetings, imbibe in fellowship, and they're okay. They're happy. They're calm. But they're not compulsive overeaters. They're welcome in Overeaters Anonymous. What terrifies me is if they sponsor someone like me, because I'm going to die from the message of don't drink, go to meetings. Does that make sense? Okay, so we're going to skip on over here to the top of 23, because once again, we're talking about this interplay, allergy of the body, obsession of the mind. Okay, I have other allergies. I actually don't drink caffeine. I know a lot of people don't drink caffeine because of their abstinence. It creates the craving. I get migraines from caffeine. I don't like migraines. Therefore, I don't drink caffeine. I don't obsess about caffeine. I don't have to make it as part of my abstinence because I don't like the consequences. I've had thousands of consequences for my binge foods. I don't give a shit. Oh, recorded. I don't give a care. So, because I'm going to keep going back again. So it's not the allergy is not the reason I come to Overeaters Anonymous. I come to Overeaters Anonymous because of the obsession of the mind. Okay, so at top of 23, it says these observations would be academic and pointless. What observations? The observations about the allergy. Be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind. The greater aspect of our disease lies here. Okay, so I'm just going to use an example. Let's say somebody has an extreme allergy to poison ivy. I mean, they just, you know, it was called the EpiPen type of allergic reaction to something. But they really, really love to hike. So what they do is they get protective gear, make sure all their extremities are covered. They know exactly where the poison ivy is. They know what to look out for. And they take their hike and they walk around and they enjoy the scenery and they see a deer and they hear the birds and they just enjoy nature. Do you think that person's crazy? No, they just have an allergy, right? But what if somebody has that same allergy, uses all that protective gear and starts walking through the woods and all of a sudden all they can see is the poison ivy? And they don't hear the birds, and they don't see the deer, and all they keep doing is moving closer to the poison ivy until finally they strip off to down to their underwear, and they go rolling around in the poison ivy. Do you think that person's crazy? So is there insanity in the allergy to the poison ivy, or is there insanity in their mind that told them it would be okay to strip down to their undies and roll in the poison ivy? So that's where we have to recognize that my insanity is not the allergy. It's just simply a biological part of my makeup. What I need treatment for is the obsession of the mind. Does that make sense, everyone? Okay. So we're going to move on to page 24. Because this is, if we're at that point where we can identify in, if we're at that point that we understand that abstinence is not the answer, abstinence is the problem. I said this earlier, abstinence does make us feel better. It makes me feel my anger better, my depression better, and my anxiety better. Okay? So it says here on page 24, the fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable, at certain times, to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory and the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. So if you go into a rehab, one of the first questions they ask you is, what's your drug of choice? And we're being told directly in here that it's we have lost the power of choice. If I could choose, I would choose not to eat my binge foods. I don't like the consequences. I don't have the ability to choose. So my drug of choice is alcohol, because I made a choice at 27 not to drink again. I tried pot in college. And the reason I tried pot in college is because they had much better food. Potheads have great food. But I didn't like that feeling of being high, so I made a choice not to smoke pot anymore. That is my drug of choice. I had to recognize I didn't have a choice when it came to my food. Because what do we hear? Don't pick up no matter what. No matter what, don't pick up. If that works for you without working the steps, you're probably not a compulsive overeater. Okay? So then we talk about the fact that we are unable at certain times. At certain times. You know what that means? At certain times we can. So that means when that wedding in 1994, where I was able to control and enjoy my eating, I lock onto that and think I can get back there. Although the rest of the 90s is a blur. At certain times. So once in a while we will. Once in a while we'll be able to go away on a cruise and not binge. Once in a while we'll be able to go to a retreat, and because everyone else is supporting us and they're watching us, I'm not going to binge. But at certain times, I will not be able to bring them suffering of the humiliation of a week and a month ago. What do we often hear? Think the drink through. Keep it green. If I can't, I think, war stories. We love hearing war stories. I can't remember my own war stories. What makes me think I'm going to remember Sally's? You know what? This ice cream sundae looks great, but I remember what Sally said last Friday at a meeting. I have to get something between me and that thought. So I think of it this way. Playing Russian roulette, you got a gun, it has six chambers. You have one bullet in there and you're willing to go like this on the chance that doesn't have the bullet in. But what I had to recognize is towards the end, when I came in 4 years ago and I became a student of the Big Book, I had five bullets in the chamber and only one left. And I was still willing to roll that gun on the chance this could be the time that I could control and enjoy my eating. That's the insanity of it. And I had to realize I was without defense against the first drink. Once again, what did I want you to teach me when I came in? How to have three Oreos. I thought my insanity was in the fourth Oreo, or the fourth sleeve, or the fourth bag. My insanity is, why am I picking up the Oreos to begin with? So that's what we're dealing with. And I heard someone, I think her name was Karen, who said today about, if you want to hide something from an alcoholic, put it in the Big Book. So they're very clever. They hid the solution in a chapter called There is a Solution. And to make it even more difficult to see, they put it in squiggly writing at the top of page 25 where it says There is a Solution. Okay? So it says there is a solution. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling page. Self-searching, what's that? Step 4. The leveling of our pride, 5, 6, and 7. And the confession of shortcomings, 8 and 9. And it says, none of us like it. I thought I had to like it. What was I told? Get comfortable. Don't worry about those steps. Just go to meetings. Come to 6 meetings before you make a decision. If I could get comfortable with 6 meetings, why the hell would I want to do the steps? Heck, I don't want to do the steps. So this is what we have to realize is we don't need to like it to work. If I get on a treadmill every day and run, I don't care whether I like it or not. My muscles are going to get the benefit out of it. I don't want to go to work every day. I think, in my opinion, I think we overrate willingness. Because I don't want to go to work. I'm not willing to go to work every day. But I know I have a mortgage to pay. So it's the action that we take more than the willingness. We are going to get results from the actions. Willingness is wonderful, but if you're unwilling and take the action, you're still going to get the results. Okay, so it says here, for the successful consummation. Do I want the successful confirmation? Do I really want to be recovered? Or do I just want to get thin for that wedding in 3 months? And that's a really good question to ask, because if all you want to do is get thin for that wedding, we've got some good food plans we can give you. And you may not need to do the steps. Okay, so it says here, the second paragraph, the great fact is just this and nothing less, that we've had deep and effective spiritual experiences. So I have to admit, my first decade or so in LA, I had a lot of deep experiences. Coming in and experiencing this fellowship is a deep spiritual experience. Coming in and learning that I had a disease and I didn't have to be ashamed anymore, it was a deep spiritual experience. My first fourth step, interesting psychological exercise. And it was kind of deep. But I had to admit it wasn't effective. Because if I continue to pick up, my first time I had 6 years. And then once I picked up, because my personal belief is my body's allergy is progressing whether I'm eating or not. So after I picked up, I could never get more 8 months, a year, 6 months, 7 months, 30 days. Because my disease had progressed. So I had to admit what I was doing wasn't effective. And it says, which have revolutionized our whole attitude towards life, towards our fellow, and towards God's universe. A revolution is a pretty big change. What I did is I would tweak things till I felt a little bit more comfortable and then go back and do whatever I wanted. I would be nice to you people because you understood me, and I would cause havoc in my family and at my job. They're saying here I have to change everything. Everything. And why is that? Go down to the next paragraph. If you are as seriously alcoholic as we were, so we have to ask ourselves, are we the true compulsive overeater? An acute compulsive overeater might be someone who eats like us, but when you take the food away, they get better. A chronic compulsive overeater is someone who take the food away and they get worse. So you have to ask yourself, are you as seriously alcoholic as I am? We believe there is no middle-of-the-road solution. Middle-of-the-road solution is human aid. Meeting makers make it until they don't make a meeting, right? Then you pick up. I remember so many times coming into OA from a relapse and saying, what happened? And I would tell them, you didn't go to enough meetings. Oh, okay. And I would go to more meetings. And that would work until it stopped. And then I would come back and they'd say, what happened? You didn't make enough phone calls. Oh, and I would do more phone calls. And I would come back from a relapse. And then they'd say, you know what? You didn't have the right sponsor. And then I would find that perfect sponsor. I really believed if I bought the right Tupperware, I would be abstinent. So those are all middle-of-the-road solutions. Are they irrelevant? Absolutely not. I can't work the steps without going to meetings. I can't work the steps without talking to my fellows. I can't work the steps without a guide. But those are not the answers. They're called tools because we're building something. We're building these steps. If we're using them as the program of recovery and you're a real compulsive overeater, you're going to pick up again. Because the program of recovery is the 12 steps. The tools give us the ability to work those steps. Do you see the difference there? Okay. So it says here, we were in a position where life was becoming impossible and we had passed into a region from which there was no return from human aid. Because I've tried all that. We had but two alternatives. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation best we could, and the other was to accept spiritual help. So what I thought for many years is that intolerable situation is being in the food, because it's miserable being in the food. What I learned from this big book was the intolerable situation is being abstinent. Abstinence sucks. You mean I have to be abstinent in the morning and in the afternoon and in the evening? That's a long 24 hours. So when I'm abstinent, I have two alternatives. One, pick up the food and blot out the consciousness of my intolerable situation. Or two, pick up the steps and get spiritual help. And my experience is that if there is a door number three, I'm going to pursue that door number three. And as someone who works with others, I need to give people the dignity of pursuing door number three. Because if you're not willing to put down the food and work the steps, I don't really have anything else to offer you. That's the only thing that AA and OA has to offer you. It's the only thing I have to offer me. All those other human aid things, had no substance in it, had no staying power. So the only thing I have to offer is the steps. And if you want to do that, awesome. If you don't, let me know how your research and development goes. Okay? So now we're going to go into, I think I'm going to leave that to the end. We're going to go into more about alcoholism, which starts on page 30. Because once again, as bad as the allergy is, if all I had was the allergy, just put me in a rehab for 28 days, I won't have the craving anymore, and I'll make that same decision not to eat that again, just the same way I've made the same decision not to drink caffeine. So more about alcoholism is the reason I come to Overeaters Anonymous. This chapter is not about people who are in the food and can't get out. This chapter is four stories of people that are sober, stone cold sober, and make the decision to pick up the drink again. So people who are abstinent, and that mental twist takes over and they pick up again. Okay, so the first couple pages really kind of try to get us to understand that delusion. You know, someday he will control and enjoy his eating. Isn't that what we want? Now, my experience is if I'm controlling it, I can't enjoy it. And if I'm enjoying it, I can't control it. But that's what I want. I want to be able to do both. So it says here, the delusion that we are like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed. How many people have said, I just want to be a normal eater? That's all I ever want. Well, let me tell you, I have a friend who's a normal eater. Her name is Melissa. And we will meet for dinner, a bunch of us, and she gets there, and she looks at the menu, and she goes, I'm so hungry. Oh, my God, I forgot to eat lunch. I have never forgotten to eat lunch. And then she orders an appetizer and shares it. She orders what other people want to eat. And then she gets her main course, and she's like, pushes stuff to the side. And I say, why are you doing that? I thought I was in the mood, and now I really don't want it. And then she always, always has to have dessert. And she loves chocolate. And one of two things happens. Either she has a couple bites and goes, oh, that's too sweet. Or she'll say, oh, I'm so full, I can't finish it. That is a normal eater. I don't want to be a normal eater. I want to eat like I want to eat, and I want to look like my friend Melissa. I want to partake in my disease to the utmost, and I just don't want the consequences. So that was a big delusion to me. I do not want to be a normal eater. Consequences be gone. Let me participate in my disease. Does that ring true with anybody?
Yeah.
So has that delusion been smashed? Okay. So we have to get to the fact that here we are like men who have lost their legs. So Barbara has glasses. When you came to this retreat, did you think to yourself, I don't feel like wearing glasses today. I think I'll just leave my glasses at home. She fully accepts the fact that she needs glasses. Do you feel guilty about it? Do you feel like you're less than the people like me who don't wear glasses? It's just a part of who she is. We have to recognize this is who we are. I don't get to say, I'm going on vacation. I'm not going to be a compulsive overeater. It's my birthday. I don't want to be a compulsive overeater. Did you wear your glasses on your birthday? It's the same thing. We have to fully concede the fact that we're not bad people because we're compulsive overeaters. But, you know, if Barbara decides not to wear her glasses, I want a half-hour clearance out of here with my car. So that she doesn't hit me. You know? So this is what we have to accept who we are with this. Okay? So they talk here about the man of 30. And the man of 30 is somebody who realized he had a problem with drinking and knew he would not be successful. So he made the decision not to drink until he retired. I don't know about you, but I made the decision until I hooked a husband, I was gonna stay on this diet, you know. And I'm 47, I still haven't hooked the husband, but that was my thing. I'm just going to do this until I get what I want, which is what he said here. And he says here on page 32, he fell victim to a belief which practically every alcoholic has, that his long period of sobriety and self-discipline had qualified him to drink like other men. I know for us, I think it's a lot equated with, I've been at goal weight now for 3 years. I mean, my personal goal was always to get about 5 pounds underweight, just in case I needed to hit that Cinnabon. No, I wanted that cushion. I needed that cushion. You know, so what happens to him? He picks it up, and within 4 years, he's dead. So the fact that he didn't drink didn't mean that the disease did not progress. Okay, so it says here on page 33, if we are planning to stop drinking, there must be no reservation of any kind, nor any lurking notion that someday we will be immune to alcohol. So once again, our abstinence doesn't change. We have to recognize if we think that someday we can have a little bit of this or a little bit of that, that we're arming that mental twist and we're going to pick up someday. So it says here again on page 34, it says, for those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. So that's one of the questions I ask the people I work with, is are you done? I don't say, are you willing to stay abstinent one day at a time? That's what we do. But the question is, are you done? Are you licked? Because until we are, we're going to be trying to use human aid. We're going to be looking for that loophole. It says here, we are assuming, of course, the reader wants to stop. Whether such a person can quit on a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he has already lost the power of choice whether he will drink or not. Many of us felt we had plenty of character. There was a tremendous urge to cease forever, yet we found it impossible. This is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it, this utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or wish. So once again, if we're not a real compulsive overeater, maybe we can stop or moderate. Maybe we don't need the spiritual solution. Will the spiritual solution benefit you? Absolutely. Remember, our 12 steps are based on a Christian group called the Oxford Group. And it says in the beginning of the big book, this way of living has a benefit for all. But for me, the real compulsive overeater, it's a matter of life and death. That's what I am forced to do, these steps. I'm blessed to do them, but I am forced to do them. So if you're someone who does not need to do the steps, power to you. Just please don't sponsor someone like me who needs to do the steps. That's all I ask. Okay, so now we're going to go into Jim. And I'm going to use Jim and Fred as a comparison because Jim is someone who lost everything. Absolutely everything. Fred is someone who's a very high-functioning drunk. He's okay. And I used to use that as an excuse. If I can get my outside circumstances to look a certain way, I'm not going to need to eat. So I just want to take a little survey real quick. How many of you have eaten when you're depressed? How many of you have eaten when you're happy? How many of you have eaten when you had a good job? How many of you have eaten when you've been unemployed? How many have eaten when you've been in a good relationship? How many have eaten when you've been in a bad relationship? You're screwed. So I really, there's nothing we can do with our outside environment that we're not going to eat. So we're going to compare these two and see if the results are the same, okay? So Jim loses everything. Does anyone know the story of Jim? Because we all love the whiskey and the milk.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we love the whiskey and the milk. Come on, it's a sugar-free, you know, diabetic cookie that was made from the milk of an organic cow that was raised in Amish country. How bad could it be? Come on, you know? So we're not going to look at that. Okay, what we want to do... I love the Amish. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to look at the paragraph before. Because we're going to see, it says, suddenly the thought came to him. Let's see how sudden that thought was. Okay, so it says, he gets drunk, these AA guys come in and try to get him to look at what was going on before the thought came. So in the top of 36, it said he got drunk again. We asked him to tell us exactly how it happened. This is his story. I came to work on Tuesday morning. I remember I felt irritated. I had to be a salesman for a concern I once owned. I had a few words with the boss, but nothing serious. Now, this gentleman lost his business and is now an employee, and he's saying he's irritated? I would be enraged. How many of us minimize our feelings? I'm fine. No big deal. Cat died, dog died, mom died. All the same. I'm fine. And it says here that I had a few words with the boss. Maybe the words were, F you, I used to own this business, you can't tell me what to do. How many of us have done that? You catch me on a certain day, I will put Charlie Sheen to shame. Okay? And I will tell you it's no big deal. So you can see, what does that sound like? Restless, irritable, discontent. I decided to drive into the country and see one of my prospects for a car. On the way, I felt hungry, so I stopped at a roadside place where they have a bar. I had no intention of drinking. I just thought I would get a sandwich. I also had the notion I might find a customer for a car in this place. Now, I know North Jersey and South Jersey can often seem like different countries. So it might be different in North Jersey and Central Jersey. But in South Jersey, I have never been in a bar, a bar, a diner, or a restaurant where a used car salesman has come up to me and asked me if I need to buy a car. Yet he's using this as the excuse. What's he going to show me? Let me show you my model car of what is in the showroom. But you see how this makes sense to him? So it says here, I'd eaten many times there through the months. I was sober. I sat down at a table and ordered a sandwich and a glass of milk. Still, no thought of drinking. I ordered another sandwich and decided to have another glass of milk. Now, this man is not a compulsive overeater. He's ordering another sandwich so he can be around the bar. How many times have you seen people in a meeting with a Dunkin' Donuts mug crying they can't get out of the food? What the heck are you doing in a Dunkin' Donuts if you can't get out of the food? I don't know how many times, I don't drink coffee because of the caffeine, but I don't like coffee. How many times I sat in a Panera having 14 glasses of tea until finally the bagel just happened to show up on my desk. I'm using that excuse to be around that. How many of us, I often have sponsees that say, well, I have to work the snack bar at my son's baseball game, otherwise I'm not a good mother. Well, what other jobs do they have? I could sell 50-50s. But no, why would a compulsive overeater sell 50-50s when their snack bar is open? So we're using that rational. So do we see how it really wasn't that suddenly this happened to Jim? All the thought processes that came in before that? So what would happen if we can get something between those thoughts and the suddenly? And that's what the steps are going to do for us. It's going to get God between us and those thoughts. Because once again, the miracle of Overeaters Anonymous is not that I'm strong enough to white-knuckle it through a day. The miracle of Overeaters Anonymous is I do not want my binge foods. That's the miracle that we can attain. So let's go and look at Fred. So Fred is the guy. How am I doing for time? Oh, wow. Fred is the guy that hasn't lost anything. He's very high functioning. He's doing well. Great college age kids, great marriage, great job, goes to Washington, D.C. to testify in front of a hearing, so it sounds like a pretty prestigious job. But yet, when they tried to tell him about the fact he was an alcoholic, because he had had multiple bouts where he was in the hospital, he didn't believe himself an alcoholic. How many of us have had that happen in the room? Yeah, you guys might need that, but I'm not as bad. I understand. You might need to do this, but really, just the meetings are enough for me. Thank you very much. Thanks for the information. So it says here, I rather appreciated your ideas about the subtle insanity which precedes the first drink, but I was confident it could not happen to me after what I learned. I reasoned that I was not so far advanced as you fellows, that I had been usually successful in licking my other personal problems, and I would therefore be successful where you men failed. I felt I had every right to be self-confident, that it would only be a matter of exercising my willpower and keeping on guard. That was my plan in Overeaters Anonymous for over a decade. Avoid people, places, and things. Avoid my triggers. You know what's the biggest trigger for me? Being awake. If I'm awake and I'm in untreated alcoholism, it's a damn good shot I'm gonna wind up picking up. So that cannot be, that's his plan though. His plan is keeping on guard and using his willpower. And then he goes to Washington, not a cloud on the horizon, a perfect day. I have dieted down. I fit in the bridesmaid dress. It's wonderful. We go to the bachelorette party. I think I'll just have a couple appetizers. No big deal. And on the way home, I'm out later than I thought. Maybe I'll just stop by the 7-Eleven. Then the next morning, don't have time to make my regular breakfast. Maybe I'll just stop and get a power bar. Because hell, it's a power bar. I need power. And then next thing you know, I'm in that cycle, and I'm having to be sewn in a dress because I don't fit in the dress 2 weeks later. Things were going my way. Why would I pick up again? So it says here, as he comes back, they're asking him what happened again. And we often hear about the promises. There's promises throughout this book, so I'm going to give you another promise in this book. It says, as soon as I regained my ability to think, I went carefully over that evening in Washington. Not only had I been off guard, because wasn't that his plan? Let's go stay on guard. I had made no fight whatsoever against that first drink. Once again, it's not the third, it's the first. This time I had not thought of the consequences at all. I had commenced to drink as carelessly as though the cocktails were ginger ale. It's only a power bar. I now remember what my alcoholic friends had told me. Now here's the promise. That they had prophesied that if I had an alcoholic mind, the time and place would come, I would drink again. They had said that though I did raise a defense, it would one day give way before some trivial reason for having a drink. Well, just that did happen and more, for what I had learned of alcoholism did not occur to me at all. I knew from that moment that I had an alcoholic mind. I saw that my willpower and self-knowledge would not help in those strange mental blank spots. I had never been able to understand people who said that I had a problem, that they had a problem that had them hopelessly defeated. I knew then it was a crushing blow. So the two members of Alcoholics come back in again. And they grinned at him, and they didn't like it like that much. And it says, they asked me if I thought myself an alcoholic and if I were really licked this time. So I wanted you guys to ask this. Are you really a compulsive overeater? And are you really licked this time? Because if you don't believe you're a compulsive overeater, you're not going to do the steps. And if you're not really licked, you're going to do the steps light. That was my problem. Shake a little Oprah, little Dr. Phil, little Jillian Michaels. Stir it all up. Add my opinion. These damn steps don't work. So we have to ask ourselves if we're really licked this time. He said, I had to concede both propositions. They piled on me heaps of evidence to the effect that what an alcoholic mentality, such as I had exhibited in Washington, was a hopeless condition. They cited cases out of their own experiences by the dozen. This process snuffed out the last flicker of conviction that I could do the job myself. Then they outlined the spiritual answer and program of action. We didn't go over that. I forgot to mention that in the doctor's opinion, but it mentions four different times in there that we have to put the food down first. Unfortunately, I think it's a very muddled message in a way. You can work the steps to get abstinent, or you can get abstinent and then work the steps. I ask you just to check your own experience. Look at your meetings. People who are trying to work the steps drunk, are they getting better? I never did. My experience with people who try to do that is they get sicker and sicker and are pulled deeper into the disease when they try to work these steps drunk. So they're saying here, first you have to get to step one. Step one, the best description I ever heard of step one is, oh crap, I'm screwed.
Okay.
I have an allergy to the body that's never, ever going to change. It's my permanent disability. And I have an obsession of the mind that's always going to convince me it's okay to have that first bite. That is the definition of powerless. Powerless is not three bites, you know, three donuts into a dozen donuts. It's that idea that I can convince myself that I'm going to have that first donut and I'm going to be okay. So it's absolutely essential that we know what our binge foods are, which does, like I said, does take more investigation. And, you know, me telling Grace to eat my food plan and my allergy foods are not her allergy foods is really a waste of Grace's time. But if I have foods that I can eat that Grace is allergic to, then her eating my food plan is going to kill her. So we have to get this message so we have neutrality around the food. And this is, once again, I think it's supported by the big book, but I know it goes against OA, so I'm just going to say this is my opinion, is we have to have this message first. If I'm 21 days abstinent and haven't worked a step, the only thing I have to offer you is my food plan, and I'm going to inflict it on you because I have nothing else to show you. But once I get a spiritual awakening and I have neutrality around the food, I then have the ability to lead you through this book so you can discover what your binge foods are so that you can put them down 100% and you can walk through these steps, have a spiritual awakening, and you can grab that next suffering compulsive overeater. I said this to the meeting earlier. My wishes is that instead of getting up in a room and saying, my name is Kim and I'm 60 days abstinent, 6 weeks abstinent, 6 months abstinent, 6 years abstinent, is people would get up and say, my name is Kim, and I just did my third step last night. I just completed my fifth step. the promise that I can look people in the eye is true for me for the first time in my life. You know, I made my first amends. I took my first sponsee through the doctor's opinion. Because we're a 12-step program. Shouldn't we be talking about the glory and the greatness of these steps? Shouldn't we be showing other people that these steps bring back us to spiritual awakening? Soapbox off. Okay. So I'm going to bring you back because we have 15 minutes. But I'm going to end early, people. I'm going to go back to there is a solution. Because we talked about the fact that Fred and Jim, doesn't matter, lose everything, have everything. If we have this disease, we're going to pick up. So one of the delusions that helped smash me is there's a solution. There's a story about a gentleman named Roland Hazard. And I love Roland because he broke a lot of my myths too. Roland had access to everything. You have to remember the time period. It's the 1930s. Prohibition and the Great Depression. People are 25% unemployment rate. People are waiting in bread lines. This man was such a wealthy family that at one point they even paid someone to go on a deserted island and live with him for a year. And the moment he got back from the island, he drank again. He saw every one of the best psychiatrists in the United States, and they loved their son, these parents, and they could not help him. So what they did is at the time there were three top psychologists, and if any of you, I have a psychology degree, I was shocked because these are the psychologists I studied in the 1980s when I was in school, is Sigmund Freud, and he had two famous students, Alfred Adler and Carl Jung. And they first approached Sigmund Freud, and he was busy. And then they approached Alfred Adler, and he wasn't taking new patients. And they got in touch with Carl Jung, and he agreed. But he didn't agree just to give their son an evaluation. They paid for Carl Jung to live, paid for their son to live with Carl Jung for a year in Switzerland. That was the benefit he had. I spent most of my 20s thinking, if I could only get in that Dr. Phil house, I would be okay. You know, if I could sit down with Oprah, I would be okay. You know, if Jillian Michaels was my personal trainer, I would be okay. If I could get a personal chef, I would be okay. This guy had access to everything, and he could not stop drinking. So he's there with Carl Jung, and Carl Jung says, I've taught you everything I know. And what does Roland tell him? He says, above all, Roland believed he had acquired such a profound knowledge of the inner workings of his mind and its hidden springs that relapse was unthinkable. How many of us do that? How many of us use our fourth step as a psychological survey that if we can figure out the exact moment in 1976 when my mommy sat me on the toilet backwards, that was the moment I became a compulsive overeater and now I won't have to be one anymore. Inner workings of the mind are very interesting. It's not going to stop us from participating in our disease. So he goes from Switzerland, going back to England to come back to the States, and he stops off in France, and someone asks him a very dangerous question. Mr. Hazard, would you like a drink? And he got drunk. And he went back to see Dr. Jung, and on page 27, he said, what am I supposed to do now? It says, the doctor said, you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. Once again, it's the mind. I have never seen one single case recover where the state of mind existed to the extent that it does in you. Our friend felt as though the gates of hell had closed on him with a clang. He said to the doctor, is there no exception? So this is the doctor's reply. And one of the things we are going to, you know, we will discover as we do these steps is that it's going to require change. So I'm going to read this paragraph, and I'm going to say change everywhere there's a synonym for change. And we talked about already, there's the idea of the psychic change, the personality change, the spiritual experience, the spiritual awakening. They all mean the same thing. This is, I think, in my opinion, this is the best description of a psychic change, if you want to know what one is. So as yes, replied the doctor, there is exceptions to such cases of yours have been occurring since early times. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have what are called vital spiritual experiences, change. To me, these occurrences are a phenomenon, change. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements, change, and rearrangements, change. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were the guiding forces of these of their lives, of these men, were suddenly cast to one side, change. and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them, change. In fact, I've been trying to produce some such emotional rearrangement change within you. So I think we're going to have to change. So what I thought, because I'm a doer, you give me something to do, I'm going to do it, is I thought I had to do more. More. Like I said, if I'm picking up with 3 meetings a week, I need to do 4 meetings a week. If I'm picking up with 3 phone calls a day, I'm going to have to do 4 phone calls a day. If I'm picking up with 1 sponsor, I'll get 2 sponsors. More, more, more. What this program is a program of subtraction, not addition. So it says here, ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces of the lives of these men, are suddenly cast to one side. So let's look at those action steps. In steps 4 and 5, we look at our resentments, our fears, and our sex conduct. We cast them to one side. In steps 6 and 7, we acknowledge our character defects. We're selfish, we're dishonest, we're self-seeking, we're frightened, we're inconsiderate. And we cast them to one side. And then in 8 and 9, we get rid of our guilt, our shame, those two words are combined. Our shame, our guilt, and our remorse over how we've hurt other people, and that's cast to one side. And when that happens, God can rise up. You know, if you want to find this book of Alcoholics Anonymous in a bookstore, you go in there and you're going to ask for the self-help section. And this is the furthest thing from self-help. What this is self-abandonment. I suck as the manager of my life, and I need to find a new manager. And by working these steps, I am clearing away all the crap that I put between me and a higher power. And then when I get that connection with the higher power, I don't want to eat. That's the miracle. The miracle is I can find ease and comfort in the fellowship. I can find ease and comfort in working with others specifically. I can find ease and comfort in a relationship with a higher power. I don't need to find ease and comfort with food. And if I don't want to eat, then I'm not going to pick up the food. And if I don't pick up the food, I'm not going to trigger the allergy. And if I don't trigger the allergy, I'm not going to get in that vicious cycle, which is what we talked about in the beginning. So my only hope is a spiritual experience. And the only way I'm going to be open to that spiritual experience is if I put down the food 100% first so that I can have the clarity of thought in order to work the steps. And I am ending a little bit early, so thank you so much for your time. Thank you.